Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, one day last month, a young woman with a small computer sat next to Alfonsine Umurera in her living room. The young woman asked questions, listened carefully to the answers, and took notes. She learned that Alfonsine's 23-year-old daughter, Sandrine, had been very sick for about a year. Over time, the daughter became so weak she stopped leaving their home in Kigali, Rwanda's capital. The family thought she had the disease malaria. Medicines did not help Sandrine's condition. In March, she died. The young woman asked Alfonsine a lot of questions about her daughter. When did Sandrine begin to feel weak? Was her temperature a lot higher than normal? Did the color of her skin ever turn yellow? Each answer led to another question. This questioning was a verbal autopsy, a one-on-one meeting in which a trained health worker asks a close relative or caretaker about someone who recently died. About 50 countries have attempted verbal autopsy projects, and the list is growing. This week, Bloomberg Philanthropies announced that it will provide $120 million over the next 4 years to continue support for such projects in 20 countries, and add 5 more. That amount includes money to pay for verbal autopsies. It will also pay for cancer registries and other programs to help developing countries collect data about the health of their citizens. Bloomberg Philanthropies provides financial support to health data programs around the world. It was started by former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
The work is badly needed, experts say. An estimated 60 million people worldwide will die this year, and half will have no death certificates or other record describing what killed them. That means the common understanding of disease and death rates, especially in the developing world, is often based on estimates. So are decisions officials make about which health problems to fight first. However, knowing exactly what kills people can be difficult. For example, in the United States, doctors are required to sign death certificates. Yet, recent studies suggest that some doctors list some conditions as a default. That is one reason why some experts believe heart disease has been overreported as a cause of death among Americans. But it is far more difficult to collect data in countries where only a small percentage of people die in hospitals or with doctors present. In Rwanda, only an estimated 20% of deaths take place in hospitals, according to the Rwanda Medical and Dental Council. The current verbal autopsy campaign was launched more than 50 years ago as small research projects in Africa and Asia. One important study was carried out in India in the late 1990s. Trained interviewers, not doctors, went into the homes of people who had recently died. They asked close relatives about the patient and events that led up to a loved one's death. Small teams of medical experts later used the answers to identify the cause of death. The Million Death Study, as it was called, suggested that India had far more malaria and smoking-related deaths than the World Health Organization had estimated. Verbal autopsies are not perfect. They depend on family members, many still in mourning, to clearly recall medical details. And the information provided can often depend on who is answering the questions, what questions are asked, and what experts think the answers mean. Verbal autopsies are much better to do that than to do nothing, which is the only alternative in some countries, said Peter Bias. He is an expert on verbal autopsies. Bias works as a researcher at Sweden's Umeå University. A New York-based organization, Vital Strategies, began working with the Rwandan government in 2015 to develop a verbal autopsy program.
The project trained government health workers who already provide health care in homes to carry out the verbal autopsies. About 2,700 verbal autopsies have been completed in 9 areas of the country. At first, neighbors sometimes objected to the verbal autopsies as invasive. But over time, most people have come to accept them. The young woman who did the verbal autopsy of Sandrine Umwangeri was Leonie Mfitumukiza. She had met Sandrine's mother through her job as a community health worker. After giving the family several months to rest and mourn, she had come to ask about Sandrine's sickness. Often stopping to express sympathy, Leonie followed the normal set of questions about Sandrine's health. The information she gathered will be put through a computer algorithm to give a cause of death. The seriousness of the discussion was broken when a family friend walked into the home carrying a 2-year-old girl who was laughing. It was Blessing, Sandrine's daughter, now being raised by her grandmother. After the interview, Leonie said she believes Sandrine died of diabetes, not malaria. But she noted her job that day was to gather information, not to pass judgment on the cause of death.
A new study has found that cats can connect with people in the same way as dogs and children. The research, published in Current Biology, suggests the social abilities of cats to form human attachments has been greatly underestimated. The study notes that more cats live with humans than dogs do, worldwide. But historically, more scientific research has centered on the social relationships between people and dogs. In experiments with cats and humans, the researchers found that cats do show specific attachment styles toward human caregivers. This suggests that cats share some of the same social abilities that historically have only been linked to dogs. Kristen Vitel is a researcher at the Human-Animal Interaction Lab at Oregon State University. She was the lead writer of the study. In a statement, she said the evidence suggests that both cat and dog attachments to humans may represent the same kind of connection that exists between children and their caretakers. Our study indicates that when cats live in a state of dependency with a human, that attachment behavior is flexible, and the majority of cats use humans as a source of comfort. The researchers designed experiments similar to methods used to measure human attachment behaviors. For example, other studies have observed how babies react to being reunited with caregivers after being separated for short periods. In this experiment, adult and young cats first spent 2 minutes in a room with their caregiver. The cats then spent 2 minutes in the room alone, followed by a 2-minute reunification period with the caregiver. About 70 cats were studied. The behavior of the animals was observed by experts who divided them into two groups. 64% were judged to be securely attached to caregivers, while 36% were found to be insecurely attached. The cats with secure attachments showed several signs of reduced stress levels, the study found. These cats were found to be more comfortable and effectively balanced their attention between the person and their surroundings. However, the cats with an insecure attachment showed clear signs of stress. These included shaking of the tail, repeated licking, or staying completely away from the caregiver. Of the insecure cats studied, 84% were judged to be ambivalent. 12% were found to be avoidant, while 4% were considered disorganized. Kristen Vitel said there is a long-held societal belief that all cats like to run and hide or seem to act aloof. But she said the experiments showed that cats are more likely to behave this way when they are insecure. The majority of cats use their owner as a source of security. Your cat is depending on you to feel secure when they are stressed out, Vitel said. She added that the results showed that the level of secure and insecure attachments in cats is very close to those measured in human babies. In humans, research has found that 65% of babies are also securely attached to their caregivers. The researchers also were interested in finding out if socialization training would change the results. But after a 6-week training program for the cats, there were no major differences. Once an attachment style has been established between the cat and its caregiver, it appears to remain relatively stable over time, even after a training and socialization intervention, Vital said. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We have been talking about Thomas Jefferson's second term as president. Historian Joseph Ellis calls it a disaster, defined by the trade embargo and the looming War of 1812.
He leaves office in 1808, 1809. He really wants to get out of town and sort of lick his wounds.
In the months before he left office, Jefferson had signed a bill banning all trade with Europe. No ships could enter the United States, and no ships could leave. The purpose of the trade embargo was to keep America out of the war between Britain and France. But the embargo slowed the American economy. Many Americans opposed the trade ban. Jefferson's political opponents, the Federalists, used the issue to increase their strength in northeastern states. The year 1808 was, after all, a presidential election year. Thomas Jefferson had served 2 4-year terms as president. No law prevented him from running again. But Jefferson had decided years before that a president should be limited to 2 terms. Without such a limit, Jefferson believed, a powerful man might be able to keep the position for as long as he wished. George Washington had served 2 terms and then retired. Jefferson would do the same. Jefferson's Republican Party chose James Madison as its candidate for president. James Madison was Jefferson's Secretary of State. The party chose George Clinton as its candidate for vice president. The Federalist Party named the same candidates it had chosen 4 years earlier, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney for president and Rufus King for vice president. The Federalists felt sure they would win the election. They thought that Jefferson's embargo on trade had angered the people and turned them away from the Republican Party. Even some Republicans felt the election could go very badly for their party. But Jefferson remained calm. He believed that most Americans understood what he was trying to do with the embargo, and he believed they would vote for his party's candidate. Jefferson was right. Madison was elected. Thomas Jefferson left the White House in March of 1809. He believed the nation was in good hands with James Madison. He returned to Monticello, his country home in Virginia, and never went back to Washington again. Jefferson, who died in 1826, spent his retirement years following many of his interests. One was architecture. Jefferson continued building and remodeling his home, Monticello, throughout his presidency and retirement. The design was influenced by buildings he had seen in France and Britain. Monticello appears on one side of the American 5-cent coin, the nickel. Jefferson's face is on the other side. Jefferson also spent a good deal of his retirement writing letters. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says Jefferson was one of the great letter writers of his time. One of his famous correspondences was with John Adams. Adams was the second president of the United States. Adams and Jefferson had been friends during the first years of the United States, but politics had made them enemies. Their friendship ended after the election of 1800. Yet, in retirement, the two men became friends again. Jefferson and Adams had what Andrew O'Shaughnessy calls a remarkable correspondence.
They discuss the memory of the American Revolution and the history of it and how it should be written, but they also range over scientific and philosophical subjects.
Jefferson wrote about 19,000 letters in his lifetime. A project to publish the entire collection started in 1943 and is not expected to be completed until 2026. Jefferson also used his retirement to improve education in his home state of Virginia. Jefferson believed firmly in the value of education. His whole idea of government depended on the ability of citizens to make intelligent decisions. He proposed a school system of three steps. The first would be elementary schools, where all children could learn reading, writing, arithmetic, and geography. These schools would be built in all areas of the state and would be paid for by the people living in each area. The second step would be colleges, equivalent to the high schools of today. He proposed that 9 of these schools be built in the state. Students would begin the study of science, or would study agriculture, or how to make things by hand. These schools would be paid for by the state. The third step would be a state university, the University of Virginia, where students of great ability could get the best education possible. The university would produce the lawyers, doctors, professors, scientists, and government leaders. Young men whose families had money would pay for their own educations. The state would pay the costs of a small number of bright students from poor families. Jefferson also proposed that the University of Virginia be built at Charlottesville, a town near his home. Many of Jefferson's ideas for the university buildings came from the architecture of ancient Greece and Rome. Jefferson drew plans for the buildings. The buildings were very well designed. Work began on the university immediately, but it was 6 years before the school was open to students. Jefferson was there almost every day, watching the workers. He was quick to criticize any mistake or work that was not well done. When he was sick and not able to go down to the university, he would watch the work through a telescope from a window of his home. The cost of the university kept growing, and Jefferson had to struggle to get the legislature to pay for it. He also worked hard to get the best possible professors to teach at the university. He sent men throughout the United States and even someone to Europe to find good teachers. Finally, in March 1825, the University of Virginia opened. Jefferson's health had suffered during his years of work on the university. He was 82 years old and feeling his age. He suffered from rheumatism and diabetes and was so weak he could walk only short distances. He knew he did not have much longer to live. He told a friend one day, "When I look back over the ranks of those with whom I have lived and loved, It is like looking over a field of battle, all fallen. As his health grew worse, Jefferson turned his thoughts to death. He wrote how he wished to be buried. He wanted a simple grave on the mountainside below his house. He drew a picture of the kind of memorial he wanted put at his grave. On this stone, he wanted the statement, "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Virginia Law for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia." Jefferson had been governor of Virginia, secretary of state, and president. But historian Joseph Ellis says it makes sense that Jefferson would emphasize his contribution to the Declaration of Independence.
Those are the magic words of American history. There's 55 of them, and they begin, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." At the time that he wrote them, he didn't fully understand how important they were going to be. But they end up becoming the creed, the American creed. And that's his ticket to fame, the basis for his lustrous reputation.
But Joseph Ellis points out that Thomas Jefferson's reputation has suffered, especially among many historians. The reason, he says, is slavery. Jefferson owned over 150 slaves at Monticello.
He wanted to take the high moral ground and say that he knew slavery was at odds with the values of the American Revolution and the American Republic. A lot of people said that who were slave owners. But in the end, he says the federal government has no power whatsoever to do anything about it.
Joseph Ellis says Jefferson was against mixing of the races in society because he thought it would threaten the American Union. But he is believed to have had a relationship with a slave named Sally Hemings, who lived at Monticello. In 1998, genetic evidence supported the idea that Jefferson fathered children with her many years after his wife died. The historian says one reason people still find Jefferson interesting is the contradiction between his words in the Declaration of Independence and his personal actions.
He is the most resonant figure in American history because he simultaneously wrote the magic words about freedom and individual rights and equality, and at the same time was embedded in the great sin of American history, slavery and racism, so that he stands astride the great paradox that is the history of America.
On July 4th, 1826, Americans began celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. But then, from Boston, came news that former President John Adams had died. His last words were, "Thomas Jefferson still lives." But Adams was wrong. At 10 minutes before 10 in the morning, on that same 4th of July, his friend Thomas Jefferson had died. Jefferson died at Monticello in his bed, surrounded by his family. As the news of the deaths of the two great men spread across the country, the celebrations turned to mourning and sorrow. Jefferson was buried the next day, as he had ordered, in a simple grave on the quiet mountainside. Thomas Jefferson continues to influence the United States, especially his words about freedom and democracy. And Jefferson's influence remained especially strong for James Madison. The fourth president had to deal with problems with Britain that Jefferson was not able to solve.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.